grandfather's, is anything working out with that problem your grandfather spoke to me about? New York, yeah?
Yeah, it's...
Okay, Baruch Hashem.
It's a long process.
Okay, because when I go to New York, I can have more influence than here, but the name I gave your grandfather has influence even from here. You understand? We have to know our roles in life. All right, another few seconds. We have to begin on time, but we can't begin early. And the rain is good. The rain in, not Spain, but in Eretz Yisrael, they're saying we're going to have our yearly quota. Yerushalayim got a lot of rain yesterday and last night. Wow, Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. And the Gush got a lot of rain. I think a place in the Gush got more rain than anywhere else. All right, today is Monday, March 10th, 2014. Again, I caution everybody, a week from now there are no classes because Haman and Ahasuerus went to battle and Baruch Hashem, Mordechai won. Now, I have a world I want to accomplish today. I want to make one correction. It's amazing. No one over the world caught my mistake, but I caught it. Last week when I spoke about when I was quoting from Hapardes, I kept on saying I'm quoting Harav Pardes from Hapardes. By the time I was quoting 1962, Hapardes Rabbinical Journal was sold to Rav Simcha Elberg. I was quoting Rav Simcha Elberg from Hapardes. So if anyone catches that mistake, the Rebbe has quoted himself and corrects himself. Now, we're dealing here with Rabban Cutler, we're dealing here with the Hatzalah, we're dealing here with one of the great individuals who left such a tremendous imprint on Torah in the post-World War II world. Whether we walk in on Rabban's total Hashkafra or only part of Hashkafra is immaterial, we have to acknowledge what this man accomplished. And we spoke last week about Hatzalah. The word I used, the Bren of Rabban, he was alive, he was filled with fire, he inspired others. We ended off the class last week, his relationship with the Rav. So we quoted a number of different incidents where they interacted, sometimes speaking the same language, sometimes speaking a different language. But one thing is for sure, that there was mutual respect on the highest order between Reb Aaron Cutler and the Rav. Now, when it comes to Hatzalah, we began last week's shiur with the endless problems of Hatzalah and the Kastner story and the trial and guilty, not guilty, and I got quite a few comments. But Ilan Risa from, I gather he's from the German community in Washington Heights, he quotes the Rav, something I said in class, and I'm aware of this, but he actually wrote it out. And it's, when I spoke with the Rav in great detail in 1983, I told you I later published, but I know that later we picked up a tape where the Rav spoke about this in the 1950s. He mentioned it at times in public drashot. But when it comes to Hatzalah, Adam Korebeitz Alatzmo, and sometimes we act, we're going to save our own mother and father, we're not going to save, we're going to choose them above others. And I'm quoting the Rav now, as written up by Ilan Reiser, but I can tell you it's absolutely correct. I remember the Shia. Kastner's actions were in contravention of the basic Jewish law, that the communities approved of it is no proof that this was done in conformity with our ethical conscience. On the other hand, when Judge Halevi condemned Kastner, Judge Halevi was the judge at the trial. I say he was later on the Supreme Court, if I'm not mistaken. I said it was a mistake because I don't know how I would have acted if I had been in the ghetto. Generally, we have no right to condemn them, nor to approve of their behavior. We cannot approve it because it contradicts the basic Jewish ethic. However, to condemn them, we are human beings too, afflicted with the same frailties and weaknesses, and I don't know whether I would have acted like Kastner, trying to save a family and a few of my friends. To retain my beloved ones, perhaps I would have sacrificed the rest of the community. And the Rav goes on and on. But the point is, a very sad point, but a very true point, that Adam Karev eats a lot small. And to condemn someone for selecting his mother, father, brother, sisters, first cousins over Jews who have no blood relationship to him, very hard to condemn someone. We would have acted the same way. And these are the terrible problems. God will have mercy that we shouldn't be mad at the Jews. We should be mad at Hitler. We should be mad at the world that allowed a monster like Hitler to rule. And what can we say in a day like this, that we're showing the world what we brought back on the boat that we seized, 40 tremendous long-range missiles, endless ammunition, staggering how much was on that boat concealed. And on a day like this, imagine Obama and the European common market dancing around Iran like the Tzaddiki Olam. So we have a right to be angry, not at the Jews, but to be angry at the non-Jews, their hatred, their enmity. And as I've said 1,001 times, I say it again, the Midrash says, Halacha, Esav Sona Liyakov. And that's very strange language. Halacha? Who ever heard a Midrash talk like that? What are we talking, halachic literature? But it's like a halacha. It can't be changed. It's something within their blood, there's enmity towards the Jews. And this is why when you find a non-Jew who is truly an Ohev Yisrael, you have to love him, you have to honor him, you have to hold him tight and dear and express your appreciation. So it's an interesting topic. It's a topic that there's no right, there's no wrong, a topic that will be discussed for a time in, as long as man walks the face of the earth. But when all was said and done, Kastner was found, the person who, there was a Machiel Greenwald who was accused of libel. He was found guilty. Something he said against Kastner, he was a Mizrahi guy, he was a Hungarian. And he was fined, I think, the equivalent of one shekel. So it also says something to you. You're involved in a machloket. You're involved in decisions which you can't be right, you can't be wrong. Also, we spoke about Shanghai, what they published there. So Rabbi Hertz from Queens sent me, he found in his library a Shlach HaKodesh. It's only part of the front title page. That was published in 1946 in Shanghai by Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. But publishing something in 1946 is not the same thing like publishing in 1944, when the money was desperately needed to save Jews out of Hungary, Weissmandel, and all that he was trying to do. Okay, let's move forward. The Bar Hatzalah continued to function during World War II. And with the conclusion of World War II, I want to introduce you to a volume, and I hope someone sitting here, someone listening, will one day do a doctorate in Baron Kutler, and perhaps a follow-up to Ephraim Zurab's work on the Bar Hatzalah, and take it after World War II as well. Now, following World War II, and I lived the period, I remember the period, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews, if not millions, in displaced persons camp, DPs, with no place to go. And it took a long time until these DP camps were emptied out. No place to go. Palestine didn't open its doors yet. It was under the white paper, the British rule. America, you needed relatives. You had to show you wouldn't be a burden to the community. You needed a non-immigrant visa. Sometimes they raised quotas. They allowed DPs in. But it was a long, tiring process. Well, what about these DPs? Here they are in the camps. Here they are trying to rebuild their lives. And the Bar Hatzalah continued to function actively till about 48, 49. They went in, they helped the people, they built shuls, they helped build kosher kitchens, they brought in Sifrei Torah. There was no end to what they accomplished. Many of the stories are legendary, perhaps the most legendary story, the most important story. Again, it's something that God privileged me to write about and publicize. Reb Lazer Silva. And this is a typical story of Reb Lazer. Reb Lezer, 46, visits the BP camps, and he has the American Congress vote that he's a representative of the U.S. military. The idea was to go in uniform, if you're familiar with the Silver Era, and Be'ezrat Hashem, the book should, again, nothing goes right if I would tell you what's going on with the OU and the publication department, and nothing goes smooth. Suddenly everyone's in a rush now to get the book out because there are problems within the OU. They still have not reached Mei Menuchot, if you know the background. I can't go, it's too much to go into now. But they still, I'm not talking about the Kashrus department, I'm talking about the big OU beyond the Kashrut. But they still have not reached the Mei Menuchot. So the Silver Era, you notice I was insistent, number one, that the book, the four editions, all have to be in silver. That's, I said, with Rebel, do whatever you want. They change the color, it's coming out in blue, but silver remains in silver. The picture on the cover is Reb Lezer Silver in army uniform in 46 visiting Europe, which really may be the high point of his life. In it, and that saved his life a number of times because this was during the Kielce riots, the pogroms, what went on in Poland. You know, the Jews always think they can go back. And it's amazing what has happened. You see right now before your eyes, look at France. If you read the weekend papers, what the Israeli are doing, the Israeli government, our beautiful government, what they're doing to help the French Jews come in Aliyah. In Britain, who would ever dream that they would come in Britain with the head of the veterinarian department has called for a ban on halal and kosher shrita. That's right now and here. So you see, either you come komimiyut, either you come standing up to Israel, or you're kicked out and you have to crawl here halfway underground to get here. So it may be the high point of Rav Silver's life. He went in and he had sewn into his coat over $100,000 in cash. Now, wherever he went, wherever he saw a need, he did something big. Two stories come out of this. One story is very famous. Simon Wiesenthal tells the story how in one of the DP camps where Wiesenthal already was a big activist, they're going to dedicate a Torah on a Sunday morning, and Wiesenthal says he will not attend. So Reb Lezer Silver says to him, Shimon, Vasimatach, what's with you? What are you so angry about? All right, you're not religious, but you're not anti. And Wiesenthal answers, I'm very angry at religious Jews. Why are you angry? No, do you know the story or not? It's classic. He says, why are you angry? He says, because I saw in the concentration camps that this Jew smuggled in a sitter. And people waited online at night and had to give him a little piece of his bread to get the sitter to daven for a few minutes. This is a religious Jew. This is religion. This is Torah. This is what you do. You charge people for davening from your sitter. And Reb Lezer Silver says to him, Shimon, I didn't think you were such a big fool. Why do you look at the viciousness of the man charging a piece of little bread to get to pray with his sitter? Why don't you look at the greatness of the people who are willing to pay the bread to be able to have the sitter for 3 minutes and say a few kapitlach from it? And Shimon Wiesenthal said, Reb Lezer Silver taught me, you must always see the other side. And he attended. That was one story. The other story is infinitely more important, because when you go through tremendous trauma, many of you, some of you have studied psychology, some of you are professionals, some of you have been through life, to rebuild your life again is very, very difficult. And here you had millions of survivors. Not everyone could come out of it. You all know that there are people who had to go into mental institutions, remained there until today in the state of Israel. There still are people alive who are totally incapacitated as a result of the horrors that they went through. Anyone who went through it, you don't have to tell you, those of you who are second generation, Did your parents talk about it? Never spoke about it? Did they ever speak about it? Most of the second generation didn't say a word until the 70s, the 80s. Then suddenly they woke up that if they don't talk about it, no one will ever know what happened. So Reb Lazer Silver, whenever people came to him for help, for aid, Reb Lazer made a condition. He'll only give them money if they promise to remarry and restart families. And you have to understand what that means. Imagine, I know people, their wife, two children killed. Women, husband, three children killed. How can you start all over? And Reb Lazer insisted they have to start all over. And I was privileged over the years to teach hundreds, if not thousands, of children who were only walking the face of the earth because their parents or grandparents had the courage to start all over. So you see, the Var Hatzalah continued. Now, a book came out. I want to introduce you to another book. It's a book that not many people know. I understand it was more or less a private publication. And someone working on this period from a scholarly point of view has to have access to the book. It's called Battling for Souls, The Var Hatzalah Rescue Committee in Post-War Europe, by Alex Grobman, Grobman, published by Kitav. Now here, again, we come back to Reb Aaron. Nathan Baruch, you see, you need a professional. Reb Lazer Silver can go and visit Europe, but he can't stay there. He has to get back to America. You can have a big name. You can bring Reb Heschel Schachter to Beit Shemesh. There's still echoes to his talk on Das Torah. It's echoing all over the world. It's fascinating. One little talk on Beit Shemesh, and it has echoes. So you can bring Reb Heschel to Beit Shemesh, but he can't stay in Beit Shemesh. He has to go back to America. He has to teach. He has to do what he has to do in the OU. Has a lot of responsibility. YU and the OU. He's one half the Rav HaMakshir. Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Schachter are ultimately the poskim, the ones who make the major decisions in Psak Halacha for the OU. Rabbi Ganak is on the ground. He runs the operation. Without Rabbi Ganak, you're not going to have an OU. But when Rabbi Ganak has a Shaila, and they're going to defer to Rabbi Belsky or to Rabbi Schachter for a Psak. So you have to hire someone. So the Var Hatzalah hires Nathan Baruch, Rabbi Nathan Natan Baruch, Nathan Baruch. Anyone recognize the name? Torah Vadas Mismach. I'll give you a little details of his life, and also you'll see with Reb Aaron. And he spends a good few years basically in Europe working for the Var Hatzalah, taking care of what has to be done in the DP camps, helping them set up, helping them get the children off to Israel, the Aliyah Bet that was going on, etc., etc. Now, who is Nathan Baruch? Born in Poland, came to America, little boy, goes to Torah Vadas. Gets smicha from Torah Vadas, and again, as we said in our lectures on Torah Vadas was a major player on the American scene. Second only to what we call today Yeshiva University. Nowadays, Torah Vadas is lost in the crowd. You're going to talk about players on the American scene. Lakewood, YU, Satmar, Lubavitch, Bavov, I think. Have I said it all, or there's more to be said? Then you come to, you know, the second line. But Torah Vadas is no longer way up there. It's a different institution today. And this Rabbi Baruch, this wonderful individual, when he graduated, got smicha, he became a fundraiser for Torah Vadas. World War II comes along, and he, being a fundraiser, being a musmach, he already sees the major players. The first one to influence him was Rabbi Avraham Kalmanovich. Now, Rabbi Avraham Kalmanovich, we've spoken about, this was the... Again, I'm very careful with my words, because we're talking history, we have to be accurate. He was the president of Mir Yeshiva before World War II. What does it mean, president? He was a shtat rav. He was a big Talmud Chacham. But he was not a Rosh Yeshiva. He was a rav in a big city. But he was a graduate of Mir. He cared about Mir. He helped raise funds for Mir. He was called the president. After World War II, when Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Finkel opens Mir in Yerushalayim, actually during World War II he opens it, he gets to Yerushalayim from Japan in the early 40s. So when Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda opens Mir in Yerushalayim, he then, after World War II, opens Mir in Brooklyn, and he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, and to a certain degree, it's in his family's hands. If I'm not mistaken, his grandson is one of the Rosh Yeshiva today in Mir. Now, here there is a fascinating story that anyone who knows the history of our people, the inner workings, will be very appreciative of this story and the insight of Rabbi Avraham Kalmanovich and how far he went. Russia, little explosion, but we won't get uptight about it. Russia is fighting a big war. Communist Russia, Stalin. Now you got to remember, Russia was an impoverished country. It was klapei chutz. Everyone viewed Russia as a world power. Klapei pnim. The real truth was that Russia was starving, and we all know what went on until communism actually fell. It was a Potemkin village, as they say. You know, that famous story that he wrote, you know what I'm talking about, where the Tsar is visiting, and to show the Tsar how beautiful they've invested his money, they built what Israel used in the Six-Day War, cardboard tanks. Are you aware of that? Israel didn't have too many tanks, but to scare the Arabs, they had cardboard tanks. They built a beautiful village out of boxes. The Tsar came and he saw these houses. When the Tsar left, they knocked down all the cardboard houses and back again to desolation. So Russia needed help in America. So Stalin, in his mind, and this is a mindset that non-Jews have until today, they think that we control the world. So he figured if he can get the Jews in America active to help Russia, it would get a lot more American money put into Russia. Well, America had put in a fortune of money to Russia to help them build up their army, to buy equipment, etc. What was the idea? To get the Jews involved. So Russia in 1943, literally in the middle of the war, the Jewish members of a so-called Soviet-sponsored anti-fascist committee, a famous story, he sent a delegation to America. Now this delegation, what was left in Russia? Who were the famous Jews? There are no rabbis left. There are no Jewish philosophers left. There hasn't been a yeshiva in Russia since 1917, a legal yeshiva. Chabadnikim, yeah, there was an underground. You know how many Chabadnikim were executed or sent away to Siberia? The Rebbe's father is a perfect example. The Rebbe's father died in exile during this period. What the Rebbe's father went through was a big Talmud Chacham. Well, what do you think? Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson descended from monkeys, as we spoke about yesterday in class with Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky and Yeruchim Meshel. He descended from Gedolei Yisrael. What they did to Mabitzei Torah, murdered them, executed them, they were arrested, disappeared, never heard from again. Lubavitch has quite a glorious history of martyrdom, lo aleinu. So, who are the famous Russians? Ah, Russia encouraged the Yiddish language. That the Jews can have. Birobidzhan, the official language, will be Yiddish. It's part of the Soviet Socialist Republic. These people are committed to communism. It's good to have a native language. Except, if you know what the Russians did, are you aware of their Yiddish? Totally different Yiddish than our Yiddish, so that no one should make a mistake and confuse their Yiddish with our Yiddish. For the sake of our argument, if we write Emes with an Aleph, they wrote it with an Ayin. And they made 101 little changes so as does so sein a Soviet land Yiddish. Alright, where did this Yiddish come out? The Yiddish theater. The most important part of the cultural Jewish existence in Russia was the Yiddish theater. Who was the most famous actor? Shlomo Michaels. It's unbelievable what I'm telling you. Who was the most famous Yiddish poet? Yitzchak Pfeffer. And do you understand what's amazing? In 1952, when Stalin went paranoid and he was worried that the Jews are out to destroy him, and the Jews still maintain an identity and a nationalism and they're not really Russians, he executed all these people in Lublanka prison in 1952. There's a park at the corner of Chernyakhovsky and Azov, a little park. When you're driving past, welcome to Jerusalem. Okay, Morty, you just moved here. Morty just moved to Jerusalem. When you're driving past, you pull over, you stop the car, you go across the street, go into the park, there's a monument in memory of all the Russian actors, poets, writers, Jews we're talking about, who were executed one night. Shlomo Michaels, actually, I don't know if he was executed. I think he was killed in a phony car crash in Minsk. We had gone to supervise the production of a Jewish play, and Stalin's daughter, who later escaped to the West, it's a sad story. Remember, Svetlana, she published books. She never really found herself. The tragedy of a human being never really found herself. She escaped to the West in when her memoirs, she describes how her father set up the murder of Shlomo Michaels in a phony car crash a wintry night in Minsk. But it was all during that period. Now, Michaels and Pfeiffer visit America. Rabbi Avram Kalmanovich wants to get in touch with them. He wants to reach them, to enlist the help of the Russians, that wherever they're fighting, wherever they go, they should try to save as many Jews as possible from Hitler. So you know what Rav Avraham Kalmanovich does? How do you get in touch with them? How do you reach them? Who gives a hoot? And you got to remember, Orthodox Judaism, Torah Judaism, didn't have the power it has today. We had no power at all in 43. Today you have a demonstration in Manhattan, 10 streets are filled with Jews demonstrating. The New York Times has an article today, let alone the other papers, the Daily News, the New York Post. Wow, this is big news. Today it's a different world. But in 1943, do you know that our good friend Rav Avram Kalmanovich goes to see Shalom Ash? Remember the name? The writer, the Yiddish writer, Shalom Ash, living in America at the time, run away from Europe, published volume after volume, accused, no, you Shalom Ash. Some accused him of having converted to Christianity. He swore he didn't. He wrote books on, I don't want to mention the Christian belief. We don't have to mention their names. He wanted to show, Shalom Ash said, the debt of the Christian world to Judaism. But Kalmanovich went to see him. And on page 28, you have the description. Rabbi Kalmanovich told Ash, they fabrenin yidden. They are burning Jews. Ash revealed he knew about the killings from anti-Nazi underground groups in Europe and from sources in France and other countries. Ash accused the New York Times and other publications in the West of refusing to publish this information without sufficient proof, making it extremely impossible for the general public to accept the truth. Ash knew what was going on. And Rav Avram Kalmanovich pleaded with him, set up a meeting, set up a meeting. And And he promised, he was so shaken by the power and force. And remember, Kamalevich could speak to him in Mamalush and in Yiddish, Rebbe, Rebbe, Hot Rachmanis, have pity on me, don't tell me more. But the meeting never worked out. Ash suggested contact his publisher. His publisher would know how to arrange a meeting. Kamenevich was with Rabbi Baruch. He took the phone number. But by the time they made the contact, nothing got off the floor, and the committee returned to Moscow. But this gives you an idea of what was going on and what this Nathan Baruch was exposed to. And then, of course, he meets Reb Aaron Kotler. And Reb Aaron, he was there at Penn Station when Reb Aaron arrived in New York from San Francisco, going across the entire country after he came in from Kobe, Japan. And he describes, Reb Aaron's talk in Penn Station, he remembers it word by word. And Reb Aaron speaks in terms of everything we spoke about, and here you find the word in this book, and I'm sure it has nothing to do with Aaron Rakefit quoting Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, that he spoke in Penn Station. We have to transplant the yeshivas of Europe to America. To those who were convinced that Torah could not take root in this Treifa Medina, Reb Aaron proclaimed, there is a future for Torah in America. But Reb Aaron said, first, Midaf Ratav in Yidden, we have to save the Jews. And here you have an eyewitness description. It's very important. Memoir literature, if you're familiar with the doctorate done at Hebrew U by Shol Stampfer on Volozhin Tales in Slabodka Yeshiva, an outstanding piece of work. Later had to be revised totally, a new edition, when the archives of the secret police in Russia were revealed after the fall of communism, because every Heimler Briut, because all the information and why they shut down Volozhin had to be totally revised when they could get to the actual. Are you aware of that? When they got to the archives of the secret police under the Tsar, the 1880s, 1890s. It's a different, it's a topic I spoke about in the past, it's not for now, but it's very fascinating. So Reb Aaron, this little kid, hears Reb Aaron speak, and first up in the Ratav in Yidden, we have to save Jews. And what makes Stampfer's doctorate so fabulous? The memoir literature. See, memoir literature doesn't lie, because it's you as an individual, how you reacted. Then, you follow what I'm saying? See, look, we can have different opinions. Sam and I can hear a shir by Rav Soloveitchik. He's also a Talmud of the Rav. We can hear a shir, and we can walk away with different concepts of the Rav. But the fact is, we do have different concepts. This is the way he impressed us. It shows us the Rav's multifacetedness. When it comes to facts, there, if we're talking about the Rav came to America in 1932, and you say 1934, Mark, one of us is right, one of us is wrong, you understand? But memoir literature is powerful because it reveals the moment, the situation, the feeling, the emotion. So here he describes Reb Aaron, and again, it's whatever we've said, I'm leading into something, but again, how Reb Aaron spoke very quickly, how Reb Aaron was nothing to look at, a short guy, but when he spoke, he was hell, fire, and brimstone. What's the word I introduced weeks ago? Abren. Okay, now watch. You won't believe what came in the email. My Talmud Rabbi Grunstein, and I thank him, is in Chicago now. He's the head of a rabbinic school here, Rabbi Grunstein. His father was my Talmud too. And he's now in the Beit Medrash of Ida Crown Academy in Chicago. Now, those of you who know Chicago, you know Ida Crown is an elementary school, a high school, a very important institution. It's the biggest elementary school and perhaps the biggest high school, I believe, in Chicago. It's more or less in the centrist world, using a popular word. I don't subscribe to these words or these thoughts because I am a fanatic in what I believe. And I don't like to be called a centrist or matan. I am a fanatical Torah Jew who is alive and kicking in the Western world of 2015. That's the way I describe Aaron Rakefet. Eisehu chacham haroeh panolad. You don't open up your mouth without thinking the results 1 year from now. By the way, following our, this is in parentheses, following our conversation of yesterday and today, I was thinking the only good thing that can come out of the demonstration is when the Supreme Court is going to give a psak. And I know some of the judges, but I can't talk with them. You know, I'll ping morals and ethics. You cannot talk with a Supreme Court judge about a case that he's going to have to sit on. But I know some of them very well. One says, they're shtickle talmidim of mine, etc., etc. One of them is retired. Him I talk with. It was Shabbos. We had a long talk and a good laugh. But I think something, this will come out of it. The Supreme Court will have to say, in my opinion, yes, the law is anti-democratic. It's not right. But it's the best we can do at this moment in time. There is a sociological reality. You follow me? And we have to live with that reality. And Baharaya, 400,000 people demonstrated if we tell them the law is not fair and we send it back and everyone has to go into the army or go to jail immediately at this moment in time, just like North Tel Aviv, there'll be demonstrations of 1 million+ people. Could be that that's what it accomplished, and maybe that's what the Gedolei Yisrael had in mind, that Eisoch HaChama Ruet HaNolad, the Supreme Court, at least let them know this is the best we can do at this moment in time. Back here. So, now what happens with all these old shuls? You have shuls after shuls that close down and they have these beautiful memorial tablets. People paid hundreds of dollars. The Rav Rakefet describes, quoting the Rav word by word, where there's room. Remember my description? That's the Rav, not me. Everyone loves it there. I say, it's not me. I'm only relating to what Rebbe said. The woman is giving the Rav a quarter every month, 25 cents towards paying out for her memorial tablet. And the Rav says, you struggle with money. Why is this so important to you? And she says, Rebbe, after 120 years, my children are not going to say Kaddish. My children are not going to remember me. But I will in shuls on in Zogun Kaddish, they should remember I once walked the face of the earth. So I have all these beautiful memorial tablets. The shuls closed down. Ah, they have assets. They sold off to a church, Lo Aleinu, whichever way, however they sold. This is why Rabbi Shalvetz had to leave Chicago. You understand what went on? The big explosion in Chicago. They sell to a church. In his case, I think it was a Buddhist temple that he asked it, and they went ahead anyway. They now have assets, $500,000. All right, we give it to Ida Crown, but you got to take our memorial tablets. And here he sees this memorial tablet from some old-time shul in Ida Crown, in memoriam, in the Presidentstätte, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Chof Ted Nissan Tashach, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, April 12, 1945, right under him is Rabbi Eliezer Weizmann, Frieda Weizmann, Morris Weizmann, but Roosevelt? Wow. I say Eidut Nemana in my house. I grew up on the wall was a Nazi sword that my uncle captured in Germany and a picture of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. My father, Zeichet Zichrono Levracha, worshipped the ground that Roosevelt walked on. My dear friends, we return once again to a moment that affected many lives. And maybe part of the reason I am sitting here, 1943. The Rabbanim were desperate. The word was out, the word was leaked, the State Department couldn't control it. Every day, thousands upon thousands of Jews are being exterminated like cockroaches. The word was out. They were desperate. They planned this tremendous march in Washington. All of you know about it. As Muri Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik said, 2 days before Yom Kippur, and Mideis Basmenta said, Erev Yom Kippur Farav, and here they have to go to Washington, the tremendous march. Now, this march, and I'm coming to Rabban Kotler in a second. I'm not rehashing this topic. I've lectured on it over the years many times in many different contexts. But just to finish my side issue, I'm sitting here because of this march. No, Morty, you're wondering, what is the Rebbe talking about? My Indian Shemitah Eitzel Hasina, it's a non sequitur. Oh no. That march turned the Rav into a Mizrahiite. The Rav would have been an Agudat Yisrael person. Rakefet worshipped the ground the Rav walked on. With all of Rakefet's difficulty in comprehending in his mature age, when he's been through Shas already 2 times plus, Das Terah, as a kid, the Rav represented Das Terah. He's an Agudist, I'm an Agudist. Nakudez, what's wrong with living in Borough Park? Flatbush? Kew Gardens Hills? Teaneck? Muncie? Etc. I'm sitting here thanks to that march. Now, what is the march? What am I talking about? And this takes us back to time immemorial. Takes us back to Shimon Velevi. Takes us back to Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu was very upset. What did my children do? Slaughtered non-Jews. Took the law into their own hands. Took nekama for what they did to Dina. That's not the way a Jew should act. A Jew, shtatlanut. Intercede, plead. The poya blight the poya, but the parrots remains the parrots. Gotta dance before him. Keep quiet. Compromise. Hide the truth. Keep your emotions down. Shpatlanut is the word we use throughout rabbinic literature for this type of behavior. Yaakov Avinu was angry. Shimon Velevi told their father, no, a Jew has to be a member of Meir Kahane's party. Has to be strong, powerful. Don't let anyone step over you. This question has come up many times in Jewish history. At times, we've gone like Yaakov Avinu, at times we've gone like Shimon Velevi. Throughout the Gullus, we generally went like Yaakov Avinu, Shtatlanut. 1930s, demonstrating against Hitler. Tremendous machloket. I write about it in the Suva era. Agudat Yisrael, chas v'chalila to demonstrate. You'll just get Hitler more angry, Shtatlanut. The activists have to demonstrate, have to say, Jews have to yell, shout, this man is a moron, this man has got one thought in mind, to kill, to destroy, to uproot, to decimate the Jewish people. Big machloket. Agudat Yisrael did not participate in the massive demonstrations that were held at Madison Square Garden. My parents were there. 25,000 people, every seat in the garden filled, tens and tens and tens of thousands outside. Not a good Yisrael. Shtatlanut. Finally, this big march comes to Washington. The Spigmarsch comes to see Roosevelt. The march was organized by a wonderful Jew named Peter Bergson. What was his real name? Hillel Cook. He was the nephew of Rav Cook. He was a revisionist. He was a Beitarnik. He was a Chirutnik. He lived in America for a while, and 4 books have been written about him. It's a very famous name. And he went against the Zionist organization and the Reform rabbis who headed it, and he organized the march. And the Bar Hatzalah and the Agudas HaRabbanim went along with him. We gotta save Jews, Roosevelt. And Roosevelt spat in their face. He did not even come out to see the 200, 300 rabbis, the leaders of the Jewish people. Roosevelt's advisors told him, these people are a weed. Geez, a Jewish advisors, a sickly weed that was brought over from Eastern Europe. They have no influence at all in the greater Jewish community. Mr. President, don't waste your time. And they gave...
At that time, Orthodox rabbis had no influence.
Beseda, but the Jews were being killed. Roosevelt didn't come out to see them. He sent down Herbert Wallace, the vice president. Moriu Rebbe said, you know how much influence a vice president has in the United States. I don't even know the name of what's the President Biden. Right. Am I pronouncing it right? When's the last time anyone saw Biden in public? Who was it? Cheney was a vice president. The guy would disappear for months. No one heard a word from him. He went hunting. He shot somewhere. I mean, it's beyond words who they put up. But, here with the biggest rabbanim. What are you talking about? A sickly weed. Reb Lazer, look at the picture. Reb Lazer Silva. I can identify one by one. Reb Bernard Leventhal. Dov Aryeh Cohen Leventhal. Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. The leaders of the Jewish people in the United States. And Hitler.
Why do you say that? It's not true. They're the leaders of Orthodoxy.
The leaders of... Of Orthodoxy in the United States, and the revisionist, and Bergson, and activist, and Ben Hecht, and Roosevelt didn't even, Ben Hecht later wrote a book about it. Ben Hecht, Roosevelt didn't come out to see them. He sent Wallace, they gave a cock and bull story that the president of national security turned out he was away on some dedication, that he went on vacation for a few days. Gentlemen, that event turned the Rav into an activist. And the minute you become an activist, you become a Mizrachiite. You had no place in Agudat Yisrael anymore. It was a tremendous, dramatic experience. Not only on the Rav, if you read the memoir of the Boston Rebbe's Rebbitzin, I believe her name is Rivka Horowitz. You can check it out. I quoted. What was her first?
Rachel.
Rachel Horowitz, thank you. I have it in my book. You can check it out in the footnote, because if I write about the Rav, it's probably in the first volume of the Rav. I don't recall offhand. But in her book, she makes the same point, that it was a traumatic influence on her husband. And the Boston Rebbe, although formerly he was an Agudat Yisrael and a member of the Matzat Gedolei HaTorah of America, the Boston Rebbe, I can tell you, was a real wonderful activist who was just as much at home with Mizrahi people as he was with Agudat Yisrael people. But the Rav later changes, shifts. Now, I'll tell you what's amazing here. And we're talking about Reb Aaron. Page 45 of this volume on the Hatzalah, post-World War II, Reb Aaron was probably the only major Orthodox rabbinic figure who did not attend the march. For him, dealing with the plight of the Jews in the public forum was inappropriate, because he believed The nations of the world reveled in the Jews' tragedies. In his estimation, the most appropriate form of activism was for the American Jewish community to aim its anger and frustration at its elected officials. He believed that only quiet diplomacy conducted behind closed doors could succeed. Obviously, there's a contradiction in what I just read, because who were they going to see? They were going to see the elected officials. They were going to see Roosevelt. But I guess what it means is that you can't do it publicly. You can't yell. You can't shout. You have to do it quietly. And this is an amazing document that when all that Rabarin was involved in Vat Hatzalah, but as late as 1943, when the facts were out, Reb Aaron was still committed to the Aguda position, Shtatlanut. Unbelievable, but true. And you see, Reb Aaron remained an Agudist. Not like the rest of his family, not like his father-in-law, not like his brothers-in-law. What comes out of Rabarin's family, the Meltzer family, the Amital family. Rabarin remained an Agudist. And what a source. Now, I want to add one point, because someone may look at this and he's going to be misled. There's another few lines here. I just want to add something very cautiously. When this book was given to me a gift, the story behind this book was that a number of years ago, I have a wonderful friend who needed a favor. He needed someone who was willing to go to a hotel over Pesach, and what an experience, beautiful hotel. The Mashgiach turned out to be my Talmid, and no matter where you walk, 24/7, food was staring you in the eye. I never saw so much food in my life. When you walked from where you slept to the, because it was a whole complex that they took over in Princeton, right next to Princeton, New Jersey, a whole complex. Wherever you walked, potato chips, every type of candy, endless cake. They must have brought in from Israel, I wouldn't say much, 1 ton of delicious Pesach cake. I asked, why from Israel? Cheaper than buying it in Brooklyn, they told me. Wow, angel's cake, if I recall correctly. Probably put out a tender months and months before Pesach, and Hashtia Kedat Ein Omeis. And my friend needed a carbon to go there and give lectures. It seems the shul, I don't want to give you the whole inside story, but it seems they had invited Rabbi Boteach to be the scholar in residence. And there was a backlash from the people who were coming, that this was not their cup of tea. So my friend, who was one of the people running it, quickly got hold of Rakefet, and Rakefet and his wife spent the Pesach that they will not forget. The culinary feast, it guaranteed to take for every day, it's 1 year off your life. Figure 9 days of Pesach, what is it, 8 days? 8 days of Pesach in Chutz Laretz? It's not, 8 days, it's not Shis, it's not the Sukkot, which means Atzeret. Wow, wow, wow. Okay. So my talk so inspired a few people, I was given a gift, this volume, by a person who was there. Other people told me that how the volume came to be, Rabbi Nathan Baruch had left archives, rich archives, and they worked on the archives, but the family already is Lakewood, is so-called, using popular language, Charedi. So there were Charedi strictures that go into the book, or in popular language, I'll say, art scroll overtones that go into the book. And they were very upset. It seems there were pictures of women that were left out. All right, I'm not worried about that at this moment in time, although women are more than one half the population, and I've yet to, I don't know, but I spoke about this yesterday. We're living in a sick time. There's no question that I said yesterday, I repeat it again, if the rabbis have any seichel, they will asa any rabbi being involved in marriage counseling. That is not our cup of tea. When a woman is getting divorced, don't go to a rabbi, don't cry on his shoulders. You go to a professional, probably a woman for a woman, a man for a man. Ribbono shel Olam, what we're talking about is a riot. They not be trepas on a riot. You know how many rabbis I can tell you find? I mean, Rabbanim, I'm still in a state. I'm not mentioning names, simply everyone knows the names. I'm still in a state of shock. The latest scandal. This is someone I know, I would say intimately. What's Lotzko going to do with his books now? Still sell them? And that's a long list. Not only him. I tell you more. Wow. One guy, he marries a guru. She was a Kohen. He redeemed Hupada thousands of children over the years. No, you're a, what are you, a Kohen? No, I'm not a Kohen. It was a mistake. My father did ran away from Chabad. A story he came up with. No, what do you do? How come you were paid to 1,000+ kids over the years? My dear students, there's another line here that I will throw out. What I just read, that's Rabbanan, that's correct, that's truth. That's the machloket. Agudat Yisrael versus Mizrahi, the classic machloket. You don't have to believe me. Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote a whole article on the Rav becoming an activist. And this is absolutely so. 43 was the catalyst that brought the message home. Rabbi Sheshef has spoken in Beit Shemesh about his hesped for Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grzynski. Go and listen to a guy named Rakefid on the tapes that the OU put out. 9 hours recorded in this room on one topic. The 9 hours, 6 Shayurim, the Rav and religious Zionism. It's all now on the YU website. All right, the Rav changed his mind. That hesped, you don't have to believe me, Rabbi Lichtenstein also said the same thing. The Rav changed his mind. You don't have to be ashamed of it. A person has a right to change his mind. I can give you the Rav's drasha, Chamesh drasha, how we change our mind. The Rav is fabulous. To me, Yosef Yechov, that drasha is more important than any other philosophical, theological word I heard from Rebbe. That drasha teaches you how to be a great Jew. Baruch Hashem. Have a right to change your mind. Not this is not halacha. This is what's right in life. And there we have to see what God declares is right. How it works out. It's not what our minds declare is right. So then it goes on. I couldn't believe this. This is Otzko. Furthermore, he feared, meaning Rabbanan feared, his participation might overshadow the presence of the other rabbis, and he did not want this to happen. My dear friends, did I tell you in this class, or was it the other class, or was it a different audience altogether these last few weeks? What happened when a guy named Rothkopf went into interview Rabbi, Doctor, Professor, Chancellor Louis Finkelstein at the Jewish Theological Seminary? Never forget it. Rothkopf walked in, wants information about the attempt to merge the yeshiva and the seminary in the 1920s. And Louis Finkelstein said to this young Rothkopf, "My dear Rabbi Rothkopf, you are making a big mistake. In the 1920s, I was in short pants. I was a kid. No one let me in on the secrets. Today, in the 60s, I'd be in charge. But about the 20s, I'm going to read your dissertation to find out the details." And that was a fabulous insight that Professor Finkelstein gave me. In 1943, how many people heard of Rabbanan Kosma? Rabbi Rubin went hysterical before. These were the leaders of American Jewry, Mandecha Shemei, Rabbi Silva, Rabbi Leventhal, Rabbi Rosenberg, Rabbi Konvich. Ah, these were the leaders. These were the leaders. Rabbi Aaron's being there wouldn't have overshadowed anyone. These were the leaders. They spoke English, by the way. These rabbis could talk to President Roosevelt. They spoke English. Rabbi Aaron, you don't even find the Rev in the picture. The Rev was there. Hundreds of Rabbanim were standing there, that famous picture. Go and find the Rev. People asked, how come the Rev is not up front? I said, you dummy, because in 1943, he wasn't the Rev yet. He was a junior rabbi in Boston. The aggravations he had in Boston. What are you talking? You're confusing the Rev of the 50s, the 60s, with the Rev of the 30s and the 40s. So I just caution a future scholar using this wonderful volume of the Fath Hatzalah post-World War II and the beautiful stories it tells, and we can be very proud of the Hatzalah work, but see it within context. Let me go one step further. So, we've spoken about Hatzalah, we've spoken about Reb Aaron, we've spoken about Mir Yeshiva, Shanghai, the survival of Torah, these people who were saved. But there's another side to the coin, which filled with tragedy, tension, decisions. God should have mercy on us. We should never have to make decisions like this. By the way, you should understand that in an army, when you're at war, decisions like this are made every minute, one minute after another. Do you send the boys into battle? Is the intelligence correct? Who do you send into battle? Which tanks? Everything you choose. Sultan Yaakov, 1982. The intelligence never reached Barak's desk. He was the Aluf Pikud HaTzafon. The Syrian army was waiting right where they sent those tank units into. And it's a tragedy, but that's the part of war. The Gemara, I don't want to go into great detail now, but there's twice in the Nitziv, in his commentary on Chumash, twice he speaks about a Gemara where at a time of war decisions are made, innocent people are killed. You can't help it. It's part of the price of war. You can't always be right. But Sultan Yaakov is a classic example how the intelligence was there and somehow there was a snafu and it didn't reach Barak's hands. And the lower level didn't know, and they sent the tanks in. You have to make terrible, terrible decisions. What about those people who decided to listen to Reb Chaim Isaac Rishinsky? Those people who didn't ask for a visa? Those people who didn't go to Sempo Sugihara. And here you have a very moving, insightful memoir. Again, first-hand memoir from Kletsk to Siberia, a yeshiva bacher's wanderings during the Holocaust by Rabbi Alta Pekier. Or Pekier, you can correct me. He's P-E-K-I-E-R. He lived in Manhattan. Everyone knows him as a teacher and a giving a Gemara Shiur. He was a wonderful Talmud Chacham and just a saintly human being in the West Side Institutional Synagogue. That's Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein's synagogue. Now, his story is unbelievable. He and his brother were Talmidim of Rabarin in Kletz. Again, the same devotion to Rabarin. This was their Rebbe. Same description. I mean, I knew Rabarin intimately, so I mean, I don't have, but we're all giving the same description. He was nothing to look at, 5'2", 5'3". But alive with Tera, a Bren. And they listened to Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grzynski. We spoke about this, right? Spoke about this in my lectures in Das Tera versus Emunat Chachamim. They listened to Rabbi Chaim Moshe. He said not to go to simple Sugihara. So they remained behind. And the Russians now were ruling Vilna. And the Russians called them in. Do you wish to become a citizen of the glorious socialist Russian Empire, which is a Gan Eden Alei Adamot, to use Russian communist language? It's Gan Eden. Nothing is better. Each according to his abilities and each according to his needs. Fabulous. You contribute to society, everyone supported equally. Why should one individual be a multimillionaire and one individual be an impoverished guy? They're both human beings. The multimillionaire inherited a fortune, he's a farmer, and this impoverished guy is a world famous surgeon, scientist, saved so many lives already. Russian system, fabulous. You have two children, you get 20 rubles a month. You have eight children, you get 80 rubles a month. Fabulous system. No tension in life. Russia. Workers of the world, unite. Comrades, will you take Russian citizenship? And now there was a big machloket. This is 1941, late 41. Big machloket, what do you do? Take Russian citizenship, the Russians will protect you. But you can't be religious. You can't teach your children. You can't have a bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is coercing a 13-year-old minor to be a religious Jew. Whoever heard of such a thing? Can't have rabbis. Or do you say to the Russians, go fly a kite. We're not taking Russian citizenship. What do you do? What do you do? So they describe it. It's unbelievable. Some told the Russians, we want to go back to Poland. We're Polish citizens. We'll wait for the war to end. We're not interested in becoming part of the glorious communist empire. And others told the Russians, we will gladly take Russian citizenship. And what happened? Anyone who said we want to go back to Poland, they were immediately exiled to Siberia. They were worried. They're not Russians. They're not loyal. Get them away from the battlefield. The battlefront, they may be spies. Exile to Siberia. Whoever survived Siberia, the cold climate, the difficulties, the lack of food, whoever survived, survived the war. And afterwards, all of Polish origins were able to get out. Many wound up in Israel, many wound up in America. I have taught endless descendants of the people who chose to go to Siberia. And you know what a tragedy this was? Because those who chose to become communists, we'll live with them, we'll struggle with them, can't be worse than what we're going through. Within months, the Germans conquered Vilna, conquered Lithuania, killed every last Jew, man, woman, and child. And it's an amazing thing. The Lithuanians cooperated. You all know, Lithuanians, Latvians, Poles, Ukrainians. There are many people who survived, particularly those who came to Israel, because the people who chose later to come to Israel were on a higher level of thought, commitment, and understanding. Many people in Israel would never speak their native language again. After what the Lithuanians did to us, what the Latvians did to us, what the Poles did to us, never spoke their native language again. Only Hebrew, or husband and wife, between themselves, Yiddish. You know what's amazing? When I was in Lithuania, it was already the thaw, 89, our final visit to communist Russia. So we got a tour of the ghetto, and they told us that the Lithuanians would shoot and kill with the Gestapo every man and woman who was Jewish. They would not shoot children. To kill the children, they had to bring in the Latvians. Right next to Lithuania, they came across to help the Gestapo get rid of the children as well. So imagine, if you chose Siberia, you survived. If you chose the easier solution, all right, we'll accept Russian citizenship. Can't be worse than what we're going through. Chances were, you would get it. Now, here's a beautiful description, and he describes, Vilna describes how when Vilna became independent. Again, you have to know, it's an unbelievable story. Vilna was part of Poland after World War I. A Treaty of Versailles divided Lithuania up. It became part of Poland. Now you had an independent Lithuania where Russia and the Germans were on either side. Then the Russians took over Lithuania. The Germans promised to honor that. And then afterwards, the Germans conquered Lithuania. But when Lithuania was independent in 1940, and the Germans had overrun Poland, all the yeshiva ran away to Lithuania. And everyone came to Vilna, and Reb Chaim Meisiger Zhensky, endless money. This is Dr. Schmidt who we spoke about, and the Vachatzala, and the yeshiva were divided up. And here's a beautiful, beautiful description of what was going on. And here he picks up on Reb Aaron, he discusses Reb Aaron, he tells you how Reb Aaron was called, Reb Aaron Kotler was called to the NKVD office. And they asked Reb Aaron, how do you make a living? What do? What are these students that follow you around? We will soon have elections for representatives to the Supreme Soviet. Will you vote? Yes, I will vote, said Reb Aaron. For whom will you vote? As the government will advise, Reb Aaron answered. All right, they let Reb Aaron go back, but Reb Aaron knew he had to leave. And here there's a description, I trust this is accurate, and here's a famous story, which people have questioned, but he seems to be an eyewitness, or at least a hearing witness. I'm quoting from page 50. Reb Aaron was faced with a tremendous quagmire. What do you decide? What do you do? Do you leave? Do you leave your students behind? Do you leave the community behind? And Reb Aaron did the Goral Hagra. He opened up a Chumash that sounds like Chabad today with the Rebbe's letters. You have a question and you take the Igrot of the Rebbe and you open up, and wherever you open, you read those two pages, and somehow you're going to find an answer to your question. So Reb Aaron opened up a Chumash, and what pasuk does he land on? Shmot Vav, pasuk Chaf Vav. Hu Aaron Moshe, Asha Amar Hashem Lechem Chotziu et Bnei Yisrael Be'eretz Mitzrayim Al Tzvatam. And Reb Aaron made up his mind, he has to get out. Only if he gets out will he be able to save the remnant that is still left behind. And he describes how the people who chose to go via Sugihara, how they get out, a smaller group remains, how they try to keep their spirits up, and once again you get the same frame of reference that no one could ever believe what Hitler was going to do. No one ever believed that 6 million, every man, woman, and child, people simply felt that this too will pass. And then comes the Selección and how they choose Siberia and they walk past their friends who had chosen to remain Russian citizens. And no one could understand at that moment in time, their friends felt bad for them because they were going to be exiled to Siberia. And their friends were still in the Vilna area. No one could believe what would happen. And one of their friends stops him in his tracks and says to Alta, "I pray I'll never have reason to envy you." And lo aleinu, the person who said that and all those who remained behind, all the Sklitska Talmidim, the Kletska Talmidim, the other Yeshiva Talmidim, 99% were wiped out to the last person. But here we come to the beautiful part. And this shows you what's happening in America. Finally, they reach America. After World War II, the Polish people are let out of Siberia. And this comes up in all the memoir literature. Some go to Palestine, some go to America. And they are going to America. His goal, his dream, to be united with Reb Aaron, to learn again. He's heard that Slutsk, his Kletsk, has started up again in Lakewood. And he's married. And when they reach America, they come into the harbor, and right away there's a problem with her immigration papers. His wife, Rivka, instead of issuing the immigration papers that she's the wife of a rabbinical student, she was given the student's visa. In other words, to get to America, you had to be a student, you had to be there to study, you had to show the people to support you. So right away there's a problem, and they wind up that they can't allow them out. But one of the immigration officials took pity on us and asked a colleague who spoke Yiddish to explain to us that we had nothing to fear. We would not be sent back to Europe. We would only have to go through some legal procedure that would take a day or two. After that, we would be free to start our lives in America. These sympathetic words calmed us and restored our spirits. And then he describes, when they're ready to transfer from the Queen Elizabeth to the Ellis Island family, we saw a familiar figure waiting at the dock. It was Reb Lazer Silver. And Reb Lazer Silver goes over to them and he says, "Shalom Aleichem, Daigetzachnish, don't worry, everything will be fine." With that, he pressed the bill into my hand. I looked at it, it was $5. I did not accept the money, but he insisted, "Take it, children, take it. You will need it on Ellis Island for drinks and cigarettes. You will..." Then with a smile and a wave, Reb Lazer walked on to other immigrants to help them as well. He describes his brother Beryl, who was on the same boat with his wife Sarah, had exactly the same problem. Sarah had been listed as a yeshiva bacha when she should have been listed as his wife. So they remain in Ellis Island, and finally, Shabbos, several women come to the island bringing with them kosher meat and other Sabbath delicacies, so we did not have to go hungry. Finally, on Monday, December 2nd, my birthday, 1940, my birthday, not his birthday, The four of us were released from Ellis Island. With the help of God, set foot upon the land of hope and promise. After 7 long years of wandering, we had found peace and safety. Now watch. Here's the most beautiful part. First stop was in New York. We went to the Bar Hatzalah. We were given a hearty welcome. From there we telephoned Rabbi Ari Kotler, who was then living on the west side of Manhattan. My ears filled with tears when I first heard his voice. Could you imagine what they've gone through? And he's able to speak with his Rebbe. From the Haratzalah we were taken to the offices of Irving Bunim. And he describes, of course, Mr. Bunim. When we arrived at Mr. Bunim's office, he was waiting with drinks for L'chaim. And Mr. Bunim knew Rabbaran so well that he was overwhelmed that we, Talmidim, we were survivors, Siberian labor camps. We had arrived in New York. He invited us to his home at 135 Eastern Parkway for our first dinner in America. Later, Mr. Bunim took us to the nearby home of his mother-in-law, Mrs. Martz, where we spent our first night in New York. The next morning, rested and refreshed, just try to think what these people have been through. Look at the greatness of the Jewish people, how we welcomed them with such love. We were served a hearty breakfast. Then we went to Manhattan and the home of Rabbi Aaron Kotler on West 39th Street, where we could finally express our thanks to him in person for all that he had done for us. While eating the delicious lunch served by Rebbetzin Kotler, Rivka and I talked and talked, for the Rosh Yeshiva showed a keen interest for everything that concerned our lives and the lives of the other yeshiva students who had spent the war years in Russia. And here's the beautiful description. My plan was to go to Lakewood immediately to join the Kollel, but I couldn't do that immediately because my wife Rivka was due to give birth any moment and in no condition to begin housekeeping. Where to live until the birth of our child was a problem. We certainly did not want to impose on Rabban and the Rebbetzin. But Mr. Bunim came to our aid and installed Rivka and me at the home of his sister, Mrs. Ida Abt, who lived on 46th Street in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn. And that's where they spend the next weeks. Along comes a boy, and here too, his wife gives birth in Beth Israel. Doesn't know where to make the brit. They tell him the hospital has a special room for the brit. And I learned that the owner of Clark's, a kosher bakery on the Upper West Side, was a landsman of mine from Kletsk. I went there, told him about our happy event, and selected one large loaf of honey cake and one of sponge cake. He wished me mazel tov, wrapped up the cakes, but when I asked him the price, he said that I owed him nothing because the cakes were a present from him. Of course, I protested. Look here, I said, you can't do that. It's your livelihood. When I insisted on paying, my landsman said I owed him $1. Greenhorn, though I was, I knew very well that the two cakes of the size I had ordered must cost a great deal more than $1, but I could protest no more. Goes back, principal guest at my son's brit, aside from Beryl and Sarah, his sister and his brother and sister-in-law, were Rabbi Rebbetzin Kotler, Rabbi and Mrs. Zelig Fortman of Far Rockaway, cousins of my mother. Does anyone know who Rabbi Zelig and Mrs. Fortman were? That's the father and mother-in-law of Rabbi David Hollander and Rabbi Moshe Scherer. Rabbi David Hollander of the Bronx, afterwards Brooklyn, and Rabbi Moshe Shera of Agudat Yisrael were married to the two Fortman girls. Mrs. Stephen Klein, whose husband was still in Paris on Vadat Sala business, and of course, Mr. and Mrs. Irwin Bunim. And Rabbi Aaron, of course, is the Sandik. And then, finally, let me end off. Beautiful. After the Brit, he wants to invite everyone for schnapps and cake, and he's ready to apologize. He starts speaking that he's only new to the country. He can't make the type of suda he knew that he would have made in Europe. And suddenly, I was interrupted by the booming voice of our dear friend, Mr. Irwin Bunim. And Mr. Bunim said, the Simchas Shel Mitzvah will take place at the headquarters of the National Council of Yisrael on each 16th Street in Manhattan. Everyone is cordially invited. At the Yisrael building, we found long tables covered with white tablecloths, and a complete dinner was served. Everyone who had attended the Brit at the hospital came to the Suda and joined in the happy spirit of the occasion. A few weeks later, they go on to Lakewood, and he spends a number of years in Lakewood. This is Rabbi Aaron, this is the Lakewood I knew, where the heart of Lakewood was the Alta Kletzka Talmidim. It wasn't yet an Americanized institution. It was Europe, it was Lita. You could feel it in the air. Then there were Americans, but the Americans, it was Americans, but everyone's background already was Yiddish speaking and Americans who could fit in with the Kletzka. That was Lakewood, that was Rav Alta Pikier. Later, he writes, he became Rav in a small shul in Brooklyn. Brooklyn changed, the neighborhood changed. He went to the West Side Institutional Synagogue, and there many people knew Rav Pikier. He was a very beloved figure. So you see the story of Rav Aaron and the Vat Hatzalah and those who were saved, those who went via Kobe, Japan, the early arrivals, those who wound up in Siberia, the later arrivals. But what a story of divine hashkacha, continuity of the Jewish people. And Baruch Hashem, here we are on this day in 2014, when we can be so proud to be Jews. Ozei Yisrael, Bigvurah. My nephew, he's a writer, he's the head of a chain of post-Hesder yeshivat. It's my nephew, big Talmud Chacham, tremendous mentor, and he just wrote about the whole concept of being forced to serve in the army. He said, weren't we forced to receive the Torah? Didn't Chazal tell us, Kofen Aleim HaKigigit? And we had to answer, yes, we will accept. And he says, at times there's certain things in life we don't realize how great the moment is, how important the moment is, what it's going to do for us, how it's going to change our entire history. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to force us to a certain degree to accept. Baruch Hashem, lachal payim shnat galut, bar shaltu banu goyim, shalorov hayu gam reshayim, hishpilu otanu, tifchu banu, va'af nisu lahashmid otanu legamrei, v'anu hayinu chasrei onim, v'chasrei yesha, עד שזכינו להקים מדינה עם צבא חזק שיודע להגן עלינו ואף להטיל אימה על כל מבקשי רעתנו. איך אפשר שלא לקפר לשיפולי גלימתנו כדי לרוץ מהר יותר ללשכת הגיות. That's my nephew, Harav Ilan Tzipori. I made some copies for you. And but I love the play on words, to fold your bekesha and run. It's a rabbinic expression, and run to the Lishkat HaGiyus Tzva Hagana Yisrael, that I can only endorf when I put on the, when I was in Bakum, Batsis Kita, when Bakum Kles Kita Umiyun, I believe it is. So you know, we were going from there to basic training, but you get your army clothes there. So when I put on the uniform, I made a shechiyonu b'shem v'malchut, that I had a schut to be the first Rothkopf in my family to put on the uniform of Tzva Hagana LiYisrael. Today already, I'm far from the first, and I've been overtaken by tens and tens of children and grandchildren from the greater Rothkopf family, Kanayin Hara, who have gone way behind what their grandfather or their great uncle or etc. did, but I was the first, and I always told that to my grandchildren, to my nephews. I said, just recall, Al Tishkachu, Sabu was the first to put on the uniform. Ad kan hayom, we did a deal, but I have to tell you, next week, it's 30, 31, what are you going to do, twice high, $36,000 linked to the shekel to get into class. I'm going to show you a source next week, twice high, right?
Two weeks, excuse me.
I'm going to show you a source that's not a Purim source, but it will blow your minds. All right, we're selling. By the way, once we finish Lakewood, a little bit more on Lakewood, the yeshiva per se, then we're coming into the very heavyweight lectures, the continuity of Yeshiva University, and all that happened in the early 40s, that Baruch Hashem, God pulled the strings and not human beings. Now, a lot of freebies. First of all, YU has published a special edition of the Torah to Go for the Chag HaSmicha, which is a week, which is, if I'm, I can tell you the exact date, Sunday, March 23rd, Be'ezrat Hashem. So if anyone's interested, feel happy to take it. We run out of it. There are more in the hallway waiting for distribution. This is Beit Hillel, once again, a very interesting articles. This is Rabbanim, who I would say are trying to be centrists. And it's a whole organization here. I love the picture of Shlomel Ariskin in a bekesha with a gartel. It must be at a Havdalah. Shlomel wears a bekesha on Shabbos. Boy, I have classmates who really outshine me 1,000 times over. And here's a picture. It must be at Havdalah. I love it. But they have a fabulous article here on going to a hotel on Shabbos. And what do you do with all the problems halachically with the door and everything else that goes with it? A very interesting article. Here are copies of my nephew's words. Here, those of you who know about Russia, this is on Reb Muttel Lipschitz, just died at the age of 97. This was Reb Muttel, the Shaykhet in Moscow. When I first arrived there in January 1981, he was a Chabadnik, and he spent his final years in Brooklyn. Quite a beautiful write-up. His children, he had to live near the children, the Allah Chabadnikim, unbelievable. This is for you, that you should bench Goyman, you're not in the Ukraine anymore. Here I gotta tell you, are you missing the point here? Are these people missing the point? They don't know the inner workings of our history. This is a Jewish books seller who's selling these letters. Chaim, you sent this to me. And here's a letter, and they're trying to show, do you remember the demonstrations in the 1950s against the swimming pool in Jerusalem? Yeah, you remember? Yeah. I remember it vividly. My wife remembers it vividly. Anyway, they're trying to show that there were bad results from the demonstration, that this poor man was arrested, and because of that, his wife now has to collect stucca, and he's in jail. He evidently beat up the police or something, and it shows on the other side of the letter is a haskama from the head of the Eid HaRedit Beit and give money to the lady. I want to tell you something. She is the happiest person in the world that she can now send this letter around, that her husband is in jail. It's fabulous. When Steve Riskin was arrested for demonstrating and the stupid Israeli police didn't know who he was, do you know how much money came in the next day for his Torah institutions? Rumors had it, millions came in from all over the world. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to him that he was in jail. A very prominent Rosh Yeshiva called me, Efshe Vesich, how he can go to jail. And I said to him, you gotta be a Riskin who's known all over the world, dummy. If you just go to jail, who knows? Your wife, your 100 students, Vesechu. Riskin went to jail. London opened up its pocketbook. Even from Manchester, some money came in. Wow, what went on? Never, they let him out at the end. The next morning, they intervened, Rabbi Riskin, he was gefreitzich, it's great, he was in jail with Kahana now, he's in jail again. I was at that demonstration, by the way, Yosef Begun wanted me to march into the horses. I said, Yosef, I don't have time to go to jail. You can go, you've been in jail for a while, you'll be in jail again. This is, those of you interested in so-called modern orthodoxy and everything going on, here's another follow-up to the big machloket going on with Chovevei Torah. Very interesting. Rationalist Judaism, a beautiful article about a famous Polish woman who risked her life, saved hundreds and hundreds of Jews, thousands walked the face of the earth, never claimed any credit. They had to look her up, only reaching her in the 80s, I think by the time they got Yad Vashem to declare her Hasida Umat Olam, they had to give the award to her daughter. It's about Irina Sendler. Now, if anyone has any love for Chabad and understanding of Chabad, what they can do is unbelievable. This is about Chabad with the outreach, and with over 1,000 kids of Vais Nishtanalev from a base, and they brought them to 770. I gave them a whole Shabbos. Remember, I spoke about this. They gave them a choice. You can't be Mechallel Shabbos in public, but privately you can either decide to try to be like a Shomer Shabbos, or do what you want. We're not going to intervene, but in public you can't do this, you can't do that. Saturday night, they take them to Times Square, and there's where they made Havdalah in Times Square, and there are pictures of the Rebbe, you know, everything flashing around on Times Square, on the billboards, the Rebbe's looking at you. So I wrote back to my dear student who's a Chabadnik, I wrote back, the only thing that would have made me happier was Havdalah at home plate of Yankee Stadium. Until we meet again in health and happiness, a freilich in Purim and easy kind of desta, das bedanya. Did Hannah Rubin speak with you?
Yes, you're supposed to give me something.
I have to zero resist.